Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Bio 241, Human Physiology. And it is October 8th, and we're going to take a look at the schedule first thing, see where we are in the class. I think we're talking about nervous system somewhere. And let's see how many days we're going to talk about nervous system yet. Good. Everything's working just fine. So, second lecture on nervous system. And then next week we have one more lecture on nervous system, and actually the second lecture is going to be on nervous system, but a special part of the nervous system, which is the autonomic nervous system. It's not a terribly long chapter, but probably would be really good if you were to read through that chapter before lecture. That will help you. All right, and then maybe we can finish up with some sensory. And a week and a half from today is your second exam on chapters 4, 5, 7, and 9. Okay, so make sure you bring in a Scantron, a picture ID. Don't forget that picture ID, eraser, pencil, and then you guys are good. And also, the sign-in sheet is going around someplace, right? So that I'm not confused whether I should drop a student or not. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, because then I know you're in class. All right. Well, anybody have a question on the schedule before I flip out of it? No? We're pretty good? All right. What about questions about what we were talking about last time? Might be pretty strange stuff compared to what you'd normally learn in a biology class or an anatomy class. So it might be kind of strange. Anybody have any questions? Been reading the chapter a little bit, working some online questions. Okay. Well, I don't see any questions from the class, but I left you with a question last time. Since you don't have any questions for me, I got questions for you. Nice. Okay, I'm ready to go now. Okay, what was the question that I left you with last time, just as we were walking out the door? Yeah, one of the things we learned was something about an action potential. Okay, what can you tell me about an action potential over here compared to one over here? What about one here and one up over there? They're the same. What about one now and one in 10 years from now? They're going to be the same, right? So action potentials are always the same. Doesn't matter where they are on a neuron, what neuron it is, right? Action potentials will always be the same. And what do we mean by that? It means that the duration or the length of an action potential is the same, and the amplitude is the same. And it's just a very fast blip that moves through our nervous system. And that's how our neurons or our nervous system communicates and figures out things inside of it, is just by looking at these action potentials, and they are all the same. All right, just a little blip if you were to listen to your brain. All right, well, since they all have the same amplitude, which is sort of like the loudness or intensity, how is it that you can actually experience a difference in intensity? You can see bright lights and dim lights, right? You can hear soft sounds, you can hear loud sounds, and you can smell things that are very faint, and you can smell things that are really strong smelling. So why is it that you can have a gradation or a graded experience, but every action potential is exactly the same? Because I might think that as the intensity of the stimulus gets stronger and stronger and stronger, that the amplitude of an action potential would get greater and greater and greater. But that never happens. Right? So how is it possible that when your brain is using action potentials, right, every action potential is going to be the same, even though the stimulus can change? Right? Because here is a very weak stimulus. Here's one a little bit stronger. Here's a really strong stimulus, but the action potential is exactly the same. Automatic inactivation. It certainly has a lot to do with that inactivation gate, which produces a refractory period. Okay, that's going to be an important consideration for us in order to explain what's going on. Okay, so here we have action potentials, all the same duration and all the same amplitude, but what we don't see on this slide is that we can have a lot of action potentials between the first two, right? So if there's an action potential and then very rapidly after that another one, and then another one, and another one, and another one, that would signify that the amplitude of the stimulus is increasing, right? But the amplitude of each individual action potential is going to be exactly the same. So if there, as we see on this slide over here, if there are no action potentials between these two, that means it's a very weak stimulus. All right, so let's take a look and see what that looks like. All right, so we have three different kinds of stimuli. Let's look at the very bottom row. We turn the stimulus on, we leave it on for a certain period of time, turn it off, right? And then we leave it off for a certain period of time, then turn it back on. But the second time we turn the stimulus on, the intensity is greater, right? So the stimulus is stronger. Leave that on for the same period of time, then turn it off. And then third time, come along with that same stimulus, but not quite the same because the intensity is increased, right? So it's a stronger stimulus. All right, so let's look at this first case. What can you tell me about the first stimulus? Here is resting membrane potential of some kind of receptor cell. So we know something about this stimulus. We're going to call it a, okay, sub-threshold stimulus. It hasn't reached threshold, so think of that action potential drawing right there. The stimulus has to reach threshold before an action potential can be stimulated or triggered. So here is a stimulus that's on, but this neuron is completely oblivious to it. Won't send that information along, right? All right, so let's increase the stimulus a little bit more. And with this low-level stimulus, it is still threshold, so some action potentials are being produced. And I see four during that period of time. And what about the amplitude of all these action potentials, these four right here? Exactly the same. And if we were to zoom in and look at the width, they would be exactly the same as well, right? All right, so then we turn the stimulus off, and we come back a third time, and we increase the amplitude of the stimulus, and I look at this first action potential, and what can you tell me about this first action potential to these four over here from that previous stimulus? Exactly the same, same amplitude, same width, all right? But this set of action potentials looks different than the one in the middle, right? So I see a lot more action potentials per time. We say that the frequency of action potentials increases. And so that's how your nervous system knows that the intensity of a signal is increasing, is by the frequency of these action potentials. We call that frequency coding. So stimulus intensity is coded by the frequency of action potentials, even though every single action potential is the same. So what would your brain hear? If it were to hear these action potentials, what would it hear? It would just be a blip, okay? And if it's a low-level stimulus, it would be blip, 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 blip. And you would recognize that particular stimulus because it would go to some part of your brain. If it was a visual stimulus, what part of the brain would it go to? Occipital lobe, right? That's your primary visual cortex. If it was some kind of auditory stimulus, where would those action potentials go? Temporal lobe, right, okay. And if it's a low-level stimulus or a very soft stimulus, then that part of the brain would experience a blip, 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 and then you would perceive an image or something if it was a visual stimulus, okay. Well, let's turn the light intensity up, right? The action potentials are exactly the same. Let's just say this is light going to your occipital lobe, so instead of blip, 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 your occipital lobe would hear something that is blip, 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 really fast. And if it hears something fast, that means that the signal intensity or the light intensity increased. Right? So that's the language of the nervous system, these action potentials, and it can tell what the frequency or how, what the train of action potentials are. And as the frequency gets faster, all right, that signals an increase in stimulus. All right, so somebody had a point, and that is that an action potential has a refractory period, right? Due to that inactivation gate, that's an absolute refractory period. That means that we can't have two action potentials adding up to each other or summating. So we can't have another action potential almost at the same time as the first one, which would create a larger amplitude. That never happens, right? Because that inactivation gate prevents further depolarization of a cell, right? And so they can never summate. And with a lower level stimulus, we have a longer period of time between action potentials because of that relative refractory period. All right, let's take a look at this. Here is a plot of membrane potential versus time. I see an action potential. So from -70 to -55,
That is the initial stimulus. It's a threshold stimulus, so at minus 55. What starts to happen here? Let's review this a little bit. Okay, that's depolarization. That's really nice. And what does depolarization do to? As a matter of fact, it's not a very good teaching slide because it tells you the answer. Okay, and the answer is what? This depolarization is due to sodium channels that open up. So sodium rushes inside the cell because the chemical gradient is inside the cell. The electrical gradient is inside the cell. And when that positive charge rushes in, that causes depolarization, and that's due to voltage-gated sodium channels. Right. And right at this period of time, right here, this is where that inactivation gate closes, and no further depolarization can take place because no more sodium can enter the cell. All right, so this is really, if I were going to draw this absolute refractory period, this is where I think I would start to draw it. But conceptually, if you want to say over here, when threshold voltage is reached, that's okay with me. But it makes more sense for me to say here is the absolute refractory period because of that inactivation gate closes. Right? And the inactivation gate really doesn't matter now because the inside of the cell is positive. That's going to kick potassium out. Potassium is low on the outside of the cell anyway. So potassium is going to start to leave, and when positive charges leave the cell, then the inside of the cell becomes more negative, and it doesn't just automatically put on the brakes and crash stop right at resting membrane potential. Right, there's a little bit of overshoot, or you want to call that undershoot, from resting membrane potential. This is what we call the relative refractory period. So that if we come along at this period of time with the same exact stimulus, which was, what, 15 millivolts. If we put a 15 millivolt stimulus right here, it would not reach threshold, the exact same stimulus. Right? But since it's a relative refractory period, it can be overcome with a stronger stimulus. Right? So what would we need? We would need this 15 millivolt and then a little bit more over here. Maybe that's 5 or 10. So a 25 millivolt stimulus would overcome this relative refractory period. And the greater that stimulus is, instead of 25, if it was a 50 millivolt stimulus, then it can overcome the relative refractory period sooner. And that will trigger an extra potential sooner compared to a lower level stimulus. So this relative refractory period is a way that neurons can code intensity of a stimulus by changing the frequency of action potentials. Right? So where would the next action potential occur on this plot if it was just the usual threshold stimulus, which is 15 millivolts? Where would that take place? It could only take place, can't happen here, can't happen here, can't happen here, but it can start to happen right here, right? So there would be an action potential. Now, where would that action potential take place if it was a really strong stimulus, more than 15 millivolts, say 20 millivolts? Then it would happen over here someplace because, right, it would overcome that refractory period, and so you would have an action potential sooner in time compared to over here. Right? And if that continues, then you would have a greater number of action potentials per time or an increase in frequency of action potentials. Yeah, I'm subtracting, 55 from 70. Okay. So that would be a nice quantitative way we could talk about a stimulus. And so a 15 millivolt stimulus is not as strong as a 20 or 25. Okay? And they all have to be depolarizing, right? They all would have to move the voltage to zero. They can't be hyperpolarizing. Right? It can't be a negative stimulus because then that would hyperpolarize and even inhibit the cell even more. So it has to be a depolarizing stimulus. Right? And there are such things as inhibitory stimuli, which will inhibit a cell. Okay, so that describes the situation here. So frequency coding is how stimulus intensity is coded in the central nervous system. Okay. All right, so let's change topics a little bit. Oh, I tell you what, before we do, I want to know something about the membrane proteins that allow this action potential to take place. There's something in the plasma membrane, something in the cell membrane that allows an action potential to take place. And what are these things? And we kind of talked about it a little bit. You see sodium channels and potassium channels, but I want to know specifically what kind of sodium and potassium channels they are. What's causing them to open? And that's actually on this slide. They are voltage-gated sodium channels and potassium channels, right? Because the stimulus right here is a voltage. And when that voltage reaches threshold, then these voltage-gated potassium channels and sodium channels start to open up. All right, so action potentials are due to, and this is a really good definition, action potentials are due to the activity of voltage-gated channels. That's probably good just to memorize right now, but you'll get a good feel for why that is. And the other thing is you should know where these voltage-gated channels are. Where are these proteins located in the cell membrane? Remember, a cell can put a protein, a membrane protein in the apical surface or the basal surface or at the tip of an axon or at a dendrite. That's the job of the nucleus to direct all of that activity. Where does the nucleus direct the placement of all these voltage-gated channels? And I'm not sure anybody knows yet, but it's a really good question. You should think about that. Okay? It's so important that I just got to tell you. Okay? It's on the sending part of a neuron. Voltage-gated channels are on the sending part of a neuron. And again, that still might be a little bit secret. What is the sending part of a neuron? It is the axon, right? So voltage-gated channels are found on axons. And in this class, that's really good. You can say only on axons. So only axons, what does that mean? Only axons can propagate or initiate an action potential. Dendrites and cell bodies cannot because they do not have voltage-gated channels. Okay? They have other kinds of channels, which is what we're going to look at almost next. Okay? All right. Who's got a question on that? Pretty good with that? Sort of like transcription, translation. Different parts of the cell can do different things. All right, so here is a different kind of potential. It's called a graded potential. Graded means that it can be strong or can be weak or somewhere in between, right? It can have gradations. And if we look at this plot right here of voltage versus time, okay, I can see that here are some membrane potential changes. Minus 70 is what? RMP. And here is this a depolarization or a hyperpolarization? That's a depolarization, right? And at a different location on an axon, look what happens to this graded potential. It starts to decrease as it moves along an axon. Now, if we're going to draw an action potential, what would be the amplitude of an action potential as it moves along an axon? It would be exactly the same, okay? So an action potential conducts without decrement, a graded potential conducts itself with decrement, means that it will finally disappear. It will go away. And that's because there's some resistance to electrical flow within the cytoplasm. And there are also ways for current to leak out of a cell through the plasma membrane. Both of those cases will cause this graded potential to decrease. Well, what produces a graded potential that we see right here? Here we have some kind of device. You could think of this as a needle or an electrode. If it's a needle, we have to inject something that has a positive charge inside the cell. What do you know that we could inject into the cell right here that has a positive charge that would act like a stimulus? Sodium ion, potassium ion, right? Sodium ion. Let's stick with sodium ion, okay? Or this could be an electrical probe and we actually hook it up to the positive terminal of a battery. That would be another way to make the inside of the cell positive, right? And then it would travel, okay, down an axon. And this happens pretty fast. It happens pretty much at the speed of light within this particular medium, which is a salt solution, which is really, really fast, okay? But, so it's fast, but it dies away, unfortunately, due to these things. So this is what we call a graded potential. I'm not so sure I'm ever going to use cable properties once again, but this is how an electrical signal would flow through a wire, for instance. And if you have a really big long wire between LA and New York, and we put a signal in the wire in LA, by the time it got to New York, it would go very fast, right, the speed of light in that wire, but it would be probably not measurable because of all the resistance of that wire. Same thing inside various cells. Okay. All right, well, let's look at an axon. So we're going to switch a little bit. Let's think of this axon, and it has certain kind of membrane proteins. What kind of proteins do we have in the plasma membrane of an axon? Voltage-gated channels, which means this axon can initiate and propagate action potentials, right? Okay, so, and dendrites and cell bodies don't. So dendrites and cell bodies produce graded potential, and they move over the dendrites, over the cell body, and they collect in this area here that kind of looks like a funnel, and that's called, maybe from anatomy you can remember, this is called the axon hillock, right? And if those graded potentials add together to produce a threshold stimulus, then at the axon hillock there will be an action potential, and it will move down the axon. So that also means that graded potentials are different than action potentials because they can add together, right? So that's a big difference between graded potentials and action potentials. Let's look at how an action potential moves through this particular axon. Well, the initial stimulus is what happens first in an action potential? Sodium rushing in, right? That's what we see right here. Sodium is rushing in, that causes depolarization. Right, and that changes the voltage across the membrane so that this next segment right next to it starts to depolarize, right? Because of this area on the left depolarized a lot because there's an action potential. That changes the voltage in the membrane right next to it. And as soon as it reaches threshold, what happens to this segment of the axon? Then, if it reaches threshold, it produces an action potential, right? And that's going to depolarize eventually this next segment of the axon. And as soon as this segment of the axon reaches threshold, what happens here? Action potential. All right, so an action potential is going to move from left to right. And you might be kind of concerned because if this area here depolarizes, why can't it move backwards? Why can't it go retrograde back up into the cell body? Why does it always go to the axon terminus? Because in this area right here, we see what? Potassium leaving. And what is potassium leaving the cell? What do we call that? That is repolarization, right? That's the repolarization limb of an action potential. And what period is this segment of the membrane in when potassium is leaving? Remember, the inactivation gate is closed. And if the inactivation gate is closed, then sodium can never enter the cell, and that's what would be necessary to form another action potential. So this area here is in a refractory period. So an action potential cannot go retrograde because of that inactivation gate. And also, when potassium leaves, remember there is that relative refractory period. And that also stops an action potential from going in the retrograde direction. It can only go in the forward direction because this part of the axon is at resting membrane potential. It's not hyperpolarized and the inactivation gate is not closed. So an action potential can only go in the antigrade fashion. And when an action potential moves molecule by molecule, segment of the membrane to the next segment, it can just flows over. We call that an electrical impulse when an action potential is in motion along an axon. Okay, and in this particular case, it's going to be relatively slow. It's going to be about 2 miles an hour when it propagates this way. The action potential is going to be the same amplitude at the axon hillock and the axon terminus, but it's going to be transmitted relatively slowly. There is a modification to an axon that will speed up the transmission of that nerve impulse. Does anybody know what that modification is? Yeah, a myelin sheath, right? And let's just say that this neuron is in the peripheral nervous system. You should tell me what kind of cell makes a myelin sheath. It's a Schwann cell, that's right. So if it's a myelinated axon, like we see on this particular slide, and let's just consider this the PNS, right? So there is no way for current to leak out because this myelin is an insulator. So when this area between a Schwann cell depolarizes, there are voltage-gated channels here that produces an action potential. Right? A bunch of sodium rushes in. That changes the electrical properties inside the axon, and it's going to create a graded potential underneath this Schwann cell, because underneath the Schwann cell there are no voltage-gated channels. So that electrical signal will flow underneath this Schwann cell, but as it's moving, because it's not an action potential, what can you tell me about the amplitude? It's going to start to decrease. But when it hits this next node, right, node of Ranvier between Schwann cells, it has not died away enough, right, because it is still at threshold. And in between the Schwann cells, there are voltage-gated channels. Right, so here we have a graded potential decreasing, but it's still a threshold stimulus by the time it gets to this next node of Ranvier. So what happens here, because there are voltage-gated channels? It depolarizes, right? Action potential. And then that graded potential is going to start again underneath the Schwann cell. And then it's going to stimulate another action potential at the next distal point of a node of Ranvier. Right, so that signal basically travels kind of at the speed of light underneath a Schwann cell, which is a lot faster compared to this first condition where it has to go molecule by molecule. So this is what we call saltatory conduction, when an action potential actually hops from one node to the next, to the next, to the next. And look at that. It can be as high as 300 miles an hour, so hundreds of times faster compared to a non-myelinated axon. And most of that is due to the fact that, well, two things, right? That there are no voltage-gated channels underneath the Schwann cell, and that the Schwann cell acts as insulation so that that graded potential doesn't die away completely by the time it gets to the next node of Ranvier. It's still a threshold stimulus. Okay, so this is what we call saltatory conduction. It's fast, as opposed to continuous conduction for a non-myelinated fiber. So continuous conduction is slow, and saltatory conduction is fast because the action potential just skips from one node to the next. Okay, saltatory conduction. That's what I talked about so far. Okay, so that ends that discussion for the moment. Let's talk about a synapse. And a synapse is a junction between cells. And I think, did we learn what the structural and functional unit of life is in this class? It's a cell, right? So if you know all the pieces, the smaller pieces of a cell, add that together, then pretty much you know how all life works, right? So it's a cell is an important concept to understand life. Well, the synapse is a structural and functional unit as well. If we know all the pieces of a synapse and how a synapse works, we pretty much know how all synapses work. And a synapse is a way that cells can communicate with each other. So what I'd like to say what a synapse is, it's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. Communication between cells. So we want to look at a synapse and break it down into its component parts. Okay. So it's the functional connection between a neuron and another cell. The proximal cell before the synapse is called the presynaptic cell. The distal cell is what we call the postsynaptic cell. So we're always going to use presynaptic and postsynaptic. And in between the two, right, in most cases, is going to be a space which we call the synaptic cleft. So there are two general ways, two kinds of synapses. There are chemical synapses and electrical synapses. They're going to be a little bit different. Most of the synapses in our body are chemical, and so there has to be a chemical signal that's released by the presynaptic cell that moves over to the postsynaptic cell that stimulates another electrical event in the postsynaptic cell. That's what we're going to call a chemical synapse. There are a few electrical synapses where an electrical signal can actually go from the presynaptic cell to the postsynaptic cell. That is really rare, but we're going to take a look at it right here. All right, so I see two cells. There's one on top of the other. I see a nice cell membrane. And I see a tunnel between these two cells. going through both membranes. It's a continuous tunnel through both membranes, and this tunnel is large enough to let a sodium ion move across it. All right. So how would we stimulate the top cell? By opening a sodium channel, for instance, let sodium enter the top cell. What's going to happen to the top cell then? It's going to depolarize, right? That's an excitatory event. Remember that. So now we have sodium concentration increasing in the top cell. What about the sodium in the bottom cell? Okay, sodium in the bottom cell is still low, right? Sodium is kept low inside of a cell. But if sodium gets to be high in the top cell and there's a way for sodium to get in the bottom cell, it's going to move in. It's going to diffuse in. And it can if there is what we call a gap junction. A gap junction is a tunnel between cells that sodium can flow between, right? And so when sodium from the top cell enters the bottom cell, guess what happens to the bottom cell? What happens to the membrane potential when sodium enters? What happens to the membrane potential when sodium enters any cell? It depolarizes, right? So the bottom cell depolarizes. And what do you know about that? Is that excitatory or inhibitory? That's excitatory, right? So if we excite the top cell, the bottom cell gets excited automatically because of this gap junction. And a really good organ for you to know that has gap junctions is the heart. So if we excite one cell in the heart, that sodium or wave of excitation will travel from one cell to the next, to the next, to the next, exciting all of the myocardial cells. And that's very important because in order for the heart to pump blood, the heart has to contract as one unit, right? It contracts and then it relaxes. Contracts and relaxes. The reason why the whole muscle contracts at once is because all of the cells have gap junctions, and as soon as one cell depolarizes, then that depolarizes all the cells. So all of the heart muscle contracts at the same time. Would that be a good idea to have gap junctions between all your skeletal muscle fibers in your body? Why would that be a good thing for skeletal muscle? No, because I would like to be able to contract my biceps and my right arm and not have the biceps in my left arm contracting. But it would be worse than that, right? If all of our cells, skeletal muscle cells, had gap junctions, all I'd have to do is reach out to grab this Coke bottle and all the muscles in my body would contract, right? They would just contract and you wouldn't get anything done. All right, so no gap junctions in skeletal muscle, but for the heart, it makes perfect sense. All right, and that's pretty much, until we get to the heart chapter, cardiovascular chapter, that's all I'm going to say about electrical synapses. What we're going to be concerned about is a chemical synapse. So let's take a look at a typical kind of chemical synapse. Here is the presynaptic cell, and I see a little swelling at the end, right? So here is an axon, and a nerve impulse is going to come down. Remember, an impulse is just an action potential in motion. When that action potential reaches this axon terminus, it's going to depolarize the membrane here. Okay? And that electrical signal can't hop across the synapse because it would have to hop across like a lightning bolt, and we don't have any lightning bolts in our body. Okay, so that electrical signal just stops right here. So this is the extent of the presynaptic cell. Here's the space between the cells, the synaptic cleft, and then here is the beginning of the postsynaptic cell, right? The distal cell in this arrangement. Okay, and signals will move from the presynaptic cell to the postsynaptic cell only. So you could draw probably a big arrow on this illustration if you wanted to, and we're going to have to figure out why that is. Why can't the postsynaptic cell signal the presynaptic cell? And change the physiology of the presynaptic cell. All right, so let's follow some sequence of events. So an action potential comes down to this, sometimes this swelling we call a terminal button or a Bouton terminale or synaptic terminal, synaptic button. It's got all kinds of different names. Okay. And the reason why there's a swelling here is because it's loaded with vesicles. And we call these synaptic vesicles. And you can see there's something inside these synaptic vesicles. And that is a signaling molecule that's going to be used to change the physiology of the postsynaptic cell. And since it comes from a neuron, right here, this is a neuron, a Bouton in a neuron, this is called a neurotransmitter because it's going to transmit information into the postsynaptic cell. Neurotransmitter is just a general name for anything that a neuron is going to secrete, that's a signaling compound. And there are many kinds of neurotransmitters that we're going to look at in this class. And I think you might have heard of acetylcholine. That's one example of a neurotransmitter. That's a very common kind, and it's used at all neuromuscular junctions, right? All skeletal muscles use acetylcholine, and it's going to be used in other parts of your body too, especially like autonomic nervous system. All right, acetylcholine is an example. Another example would be norepinephrine. Another one might be serotonin. Another one might be dopamine, right? And we might look at some of these different neurons and what they do in the body as we go through the class. All right, so let's just say this is acetylcholine. And a nerve impulse comes down, right? Action potential in motion. What happens to the cell membrane as the action potential reaches the Bouton terminale? What happens? Depolarization, right? Depolarization takes place. And it just so happens that in this terminal button, there are other kinds of membrane proteins, and these are voltage-gated calcium channels. So when the voltage changes, when it starts to depolarize, it opens these calcium channels. And which way is calcium going to move, or will it move at all? Where is calcium at a high concentration? You had to memorize this for the first test, right? It's high outside the cell, and it's almost zero inside the cell, so there is a large force trying to draw it inside the cell as soon as there's a way to do it. Why can't calcium enter the cell without this channel opening up? You know the physical chemistry of that. Why can't calcium enter the cell unless this channel opens up? Because just like sodium, it is hydrophilic. And only hydrophobic compounds can move through the cell membrane because the inner part of the cell membrane is hydrophobic, right? So calcium is excluded because it's an ion. Until these channels open up. These channels open up because an action potential changes the membrane potential because it's a voltage-gated channel. Calcium enters the cell. That's an important signal for things inside the cell. It binds to a molecule called calmodulin. Cal stands for calcium. Modulin means that it's a modulator. It's a special modulator molecule. And it can bind to a protein kinase. When it binds to a protein kinase, it can act as an allosteric exciter. And it can then change the activity of this protein kinase from an inactive form to an active form. All right, so what does a kinase do? It runs around and adds a phosphate to other kinds of molecules inside the cell if they have the right shape, right? There's an active site, and if that molecule has the right shape, it will bind to that enzyme, and this enzyme here, protein kinase, will phosphorylate it. And so the protein kinase becomes active. It runs around and phosphorylates a bunch of other molecules inside this terminal right here. And then these vesicles will move over to the presynaptic membrane that we have here. And when they fuse, okay, then whatever inside the vesicle is exocytosed or secreted into the synaptic cleft. And so calcium is very important because it allows for the release of neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. All right, so now we have high concentration of neurotransmitter near the presynaptic cell, low neurotransmitter concentration at the postsynaptic cell. So what is this neurotransmitter going to do, or this acetylcholine? Just move by diffusion across the synaptic cleft, okay? And then the postsynaptic cell will be able to recognize this neurotransmitter if it has what? It's got to have a receptor, right? So there's got to be a membrane protein that has a complementary shape to the shape of this neurotransmitter. And we're going to maybe look at some of these different kinds of receptors in just a little bit. All right, so and then when this neurotransmitter binds to the receptor, that's going to open up sodium channels. So the receptor is also coupled to a sodium channel. The sodium channel opens, so what happens to the postsynaptic cell then? Sodium is high outside, sodium is low inside. This neurotransmitter binds to receptor, opens up a sodium channel, so where is sodium going to go? Outside to inside or inside to outside? Outside to inside, what do we call that outside to inside motion? That is depolarization, and what kind of event is that? That is excitatory, right? Okay, when sodium enters the cell, that's an excitatory event that produces a graded potential, right, that produces that graded potential. And how does that graded potential flow over this part of the cell? With decrement, right? It started here, but then it's going to travel, and as it travels, it will start to decrease. If it bumps into another graded potential, what can those two graded potentials do? They can add together. They can summate, right, and then travel to other parts of the neuron. So the kind of receptor right here that binds to the neurotransmitter is called a ligand-gated channel. Not a voltage-gated channel, but ligand. A ligand is just a small little molecule that binds to a receptor someplace. So the neurotransmitter is a ligand. It binds to the receptor, which is a ligand-gated channel, and it causes that sodium channel to open up, causing depolarization or excitation of the postsynaptic cell. Okay, your book probably goes into some other little details right here, but that's kind of it in a nutshell. So what ion is very, I tell you what, when a signal moves from the presynaptic to the postsynaptic cell, we call that synaptic transmission. There is a special ion that's necessary for synaptic transmission. It acts as a signaling molecule inside the presynaptic cell. And you see it on the slide, and it is calcium. That's right. Where else do you know that you should have proper levels of calcium? In bones, right? In bones to make them strong. I think you said bones. I heard you say something. Okay. So you need calcium in bones to make them strong. But you know, as we grow older, it's difficult. It gets more and more difficult for our body to maintain proper calcium. And in anatomy, you learn that bones are considered a reservoir of calcium in our body. All right. So as we grow older, when we can't have proper levels of calcium, where would you choose to put calcium if you were your body? Strange way of thinking about it. Would you put calcium in this extracellular space, which would then allow synaptic transmission or communication between neurons, or would you keep all that calcium in bones to make bones strong so that they never broke? And you can't have both places. What would be more important for you? So that you have a nervous system that functions or a bone that is nice and strong? Okay, so it's much more important to have a nervous system that functions. It's more important to have a nervous system with synaptic transmission than to have strong bones, right? And your body makes that same decision as well. And so what happens as we get older? We lose bone density, right? And if it gets to a certain point, then those bones get very brittle. And what do we call that condition? That's osteoporosis, right? So men and women can get osteoporosis. All right, but there's a way to protect yourself from osteoporosis. And how is that? Yes, diet and exercise. The reason why everybody hates me and hates this class, right? But what kind of diet do you have to have? The diet part is not too bad. High in calcium, right? So you do have to have a diet that has adequate calcium. That's part of it, but you also have to have a diet that has vitamin D. Your body can't make vitamin D. Vitamin D is necessary for you to absorb calcium from your digestive tract. So you could have a diet high in calcium but not be able to absorb it. Vitamin D allows you to absorb it. All right, so now you have high calcium inside your body, but there's something else you have to do to make sure that you can retain that calcium once it gets inside your body. And that is the exercise part. And the kind of exercise is weight-bearing exercise, the kind of exercise that puts stress on your bones. Because if you put stress on a muscle, what happens to it? It gets bigger and stronger. If you put stress on a bone, guess what happens to it? It gets bigger and stronger too, because bone is a living tissue just like muscle, right? Okay, so that can protect yourself from osteoporosis. The people that are most susceptible are those that start off with thinner bones, smaller bones, right? And that's why women suffer from osteoporosis a little bit more frequently compared to males, because males have a little bit bigger bone structure because of testosterone. So they can afford to lose more calcium in bones before they get weak and brittle. Okay. But everybody should be concerned about that, if you're lucky enough to live long enough. All right, so here we got some slides getting back to synaptic transmission. I think I've talked about all of this already, talked about that, talked about calmodulin. Okay, what does calmodulin do? It activates a protein kinase. All right, so there's calcium binding to this molecule. It's a binding molecule for calcium. And what does a protein kinase do? It phosphorylates some other kinds of chemicals or proteins inside the synaptic terminal. And when a phosphate is added to a molecule, what does that do to the shape of that molecule? It changes the shape. And it might be more than just putting a little phosphate in a particular area, but it might really change the tertiary structure of that protein, okay? Because of the electrical properties and just the nature of that phosphate group. It's pretty big. All right, so compared to your whole body, what is your fingertip like? Is it like a major part of your body? You consider this just your fingertip, okay? It's kind of small, right? So consider that like a phosphate, an inorganic phosphate atom. Take this fingertip and poke it into the side of somebody that you're sitting next to, and let's see if they change shape. I would guess they would, right? Okay, so think of a protein kinase as like a fingertip poking another molecule. It's going to change shape, and enough to where it's going to change the physiology of that molecule. So a kinase is important. It's a regulatory enzyme. But of course, if this system is going to be under precise control and balance, besides the kinase, what else should that cell have? Should have a phosphatase, right? Because a phosphatase will take a phosphate off of a molecule, and it's the balance between those two enzymes that will provide precise control and balance. Okay, but right now we're just going to focus on this kinase. Okay. All right, so those ligand-gated channels that we were talking about here, okay, these ligand-gated channels are found on dendrites and cell bodies. Typically, we don't find them on axons. At least right now, we're going to say we don't find those on axons. What kind of channel do we find on axons? Voltage-gated channels that can produce action potentials. What kind of channels do we have on dendrites and cell bodies? Ligand-gated channels. And can a ligand-gated channel produce an action potential? They cannot, but they produce a potential. What kind of membrane potential do they produce? They produce a graded potential, right? A graded potential, and that's kind of nice because graded potentials can summate. The bad thing about a graded potential is that it's going to die away, but it doesn't have far to go. Graded potentials only have to go to the axon hillock because then it will bump into voltage-gated channels, right? And then that will send signal down the axon. All right, so ligand-gated channels produce graded potentials. We find them on dendrites and cell bodies. Okay. All right, well, we know that if it's a sodium channel that opens, that produces depolarization, and you know that to be an excitatory signal, but some ligand-gated channels will open up channels that will allow potassium to leave the cell. So what's going to happen to the electrical property of the cell if a potassium channel is open instead of a sodium channel? What happens when a positive charge leaves the inside of a cell? They become more negative, stay the same charge, or become more positive? It becomes more negative, right? When a potassium leaves the cell, the inside of the cell becomes more negative. What do we call that? That is hyperpolarization. And is that excitatory or inhibitory? That's inhibitory because the membrane potential has moved farther and farther away from that threshold level. All right, so ligand-gated channels can produce either excitation or inhibition depending on what kind of channel it is. All right, so these receptor proteins, and they're going to be on the postsynaptic membrane, namely what, dendrites and cell bodies. And so another name for a ligand-gated channel is a chemically regulated channel, because a ligand is a chemical like a neurotransmitter. If a ligand binds to a sodium channel, right, we call that a depolarizing channel, it produces an excitatory postsynaptic potential. Why postsynaptic? Because it's on the postsynaptic membrane. Okay? And it's excitatory because it causes depolarization. Well, it causes depolarization, but there are no voltage-gated channels on that dendrite. And that depolarization is a change in voltage, so they call that a potential. So excitatory postsynaptic potential
will drive the membrane potential closer to threshold, right, because it's depolarization, and hence it's an excitatory signal. There can be hyperpolarizing channels. Maybe it's a potassium channel that opens up. And if it hyperpolarizes the membrane, that's inhibitory. So those kind of graded potentials are what we call inhibitory postsynaptic potentials. So dendrites and cell bodies can have either EPSPs or IPSPs, depending on what kind of channel is open. And even there could be chlorine channels, for instance. Where's chlorine at a high concentration? It's at a high concentration outside the cell. So it wants to go inside, even though it's a little bit negative on the inside. So if a chloride channel opens up and chlorine enters the cell, what happens to the membrane potential then? Chlorine has what kind of charge? Is it a cation or anion? It's an, what kind of ion is it? It's an anion. So it has a negative charge. What happens to the membrane voltage when a negative charge enters? Would it depolarize or hyperpolarize? It hyperpolarizes, right? And that is what? Inhibitory. So if it's a chlorine channel, that's an inhibitory event on that postsynaptic cell. So a chlorine channel can produce IPSPs. Opening of a potassium channel can produce IPSPs. Opening of a sodium channel can produce or produces what? EPSPs. And these are graded potentials. So they will travel, they'll die away as they travel, but if they bump into each other, what will happen? They will add together. They can summate, unlike an action potential, and if you have an IPSP with the same magnitude as an EPSP, right, the same deviation, and they join together, what are you going to get? Absolutely nothing. Okay? So that is interesting, and we're going to find out why that's interesting. All right, so these EPSPs will travel over the cell, get down into the axon hillock, and they can affect voltage-gated channels, right, at the axon hillock if they summate to reach threshold. That's the deal. They still have to reach threshold. And if there's a lot of IPSPs, then, of course, it's never going to reach threshold. Okay, that cell will be inhibited. All right, so let's look at some graded potentials, some nice things about them. I think maybe I've talked about this already. EPSPs, IPSPs are graded potentials. They're not action potentials. Right? Since they're graded potentials, they are not due to voltage-gated channels. What kind of channels produce graded potentials? Ligand-gated channels. Right? Ligand-gated channels. And where do you find ligand-gated channels? Dendrites and cell bodies. And that ligand is like a signal. So that's why we say dendrites and cell body are the receiving end of a neuron. Because what? They're receiving information from the presynaptic cell in the form of a neurotransmitter. The postsynaptic cell will recognize it if it has a receptor for it. All right? And then that receptor will open up a channel. And it can be an excitatory channel like sodium or an inhibitory channel like chlorine or potassium. All right, so graded potentials are due to ligand-gated channels, dendrite and cell body only, not axons. Right? Graded potentials are variable in amplitude, unlike an action potential, which is always constant. Graded potentials propagate with decrement. That means they die away as they travel over a dendrite and cell body, unlike an action potential. And graded potentials can summate. They can add together. Right? If you have an EPSP and IPSP, they can cancel each other out. Or if you have a couple EPSPs that are sub-threshold, they can add up to reach a threshold stimulus. Okay. So what part is of the neuron is the receiving part? Dendrites and cell bodies. And more importantly, why? What makes a dendrite and cell body the receiving part? Because a certain kind of protein in the membrane, which is a ligand-gated channel, right? So the dendrite and cell body is the receiving part because it has a ligand-gated channel. What part of the neuron is the sending part? The axon. And why? Because it has voltage-gated channels. Okay. All right. So this is pretty strange stuff for usually what we're commonly thinking about in terms of anatomy. But it's very important that you guys know this. Okay, so here I see a nice neuron. It's myelinated. Yeah, that's nice. I see some presynaptic neurons, right? So here's a presynaptic. Here's another neuron that has communication on the cell body of this one. So these two are
presynaptic cell. Here's the postsynaptic cell. Okay, so graded potentials are going to be produced, right, in these synapses, and they're going to travel over the whole cell body and finally get funneled down into this axon hillock. And if the graded potentials add up to threshold, that's going to start an action potential right here, and it's going to hop down the axon very rapidly because it's a myelinated axon. Okay, so this area right here, right, the receiving part, the cell body, we say this is also an integration center because it's receiving signals from all over the place. Okay, there can be thousands, tens of thousands of synapses on this cell body and dendrites, and some of these synapses are excitatory, some are inhibitory, and since graded potentials can summate, what kind of operation is integration? What kind of operation is integration? It is adding things together. Integration is adding things together. And what is summation? Adding things together. If we add graded potentials together, that's an integration function, right? And so that integration function happens on the cell body, and then that information, after it's all integrated together, moves to the axon hillock, and then this neuron can decide whether or not to send an action potential, send that information down the axon. Based on what? Why is this neuron going to decide what to do? Because of that threshold voltage, right? All those graded potentials have to reach threshold. So every single neuron is very interesting because it just doesn't transmit information, but it gets information from every place, analyzes it all together, puts it all together, and then makes a decision on whether to send that information to another neuron. Right, so every little neuron in your body can make a decision. That's pretty amazing. Millions and millions and millions of neurons are making decisions all the time. All right, so this integration center, what kind of channels do we have within the integration center? Ligand-gated channels, right? They can produce EPSPs or IPSPs, graded potentials, they can summate, right? In the impulse conduction region, which is the axon, has what kind of channels? Voltage-gated channels that can produce an action potential, right? And since it's myelinated, it's going to zip on down. And then when it reaches the axon terminus, if it's an action potential will always reach down over here, it's going to release neurotransmitter, which can stimulate a postsynaptic cell. And you know what? This neurotransmitter right here can be excitatory or inhibitory as well. This neuron can inhibit other neurons, or it can excite other neurons, depending on what kind of neurotransmitter that is. Okay. In the study guide, I had a student that drew out a neuron, very nice, kind of like this, and is labeled with all kinds of stuff. Does anybody have that example? Yeah, that's it. I don't have a picture of it. Okay. And you should be able to reproduce that neuron with all the little different pieces to it and the different channels that a neuron has. That will go a long way in helping you understand a lot about the nervous system. Okay, so what do we have? Synaptic transmission, right? Action potential reaches, is conducted by an axon, it starts. Where does an action potential start? What part of a neuron? The axon hillock. So the axon hillock is the first part of a neuron that has voltage-gated channels. And so action potential moves down to the axon terminal. That opens calcium-gated, voltage-gated channels, right? Got to make sure that's a voltage-gated channel. That causes release of neurotransmitter. Neurotransmitter diffuses across the synaptic cleft, right? Binds to a ligand-gated channel. And if it's excitatory, it's a sodium channel. Sodium rushes inside the postsynaptic neuron, right? And produces an EPSP, which flows over, gets down into the axon hillock. And if it's still at threshold by the time it gets there, then that's going to open a voltage-gated channel and start an action potential. And that action potential then is conducted all the way down to the axon terminus of the postsynaptic cell. And that process can happen again with the postsynaptic cell once again, down below this one here. All right, so that is synaptic transmission. I would say probably one of the more important ions, right, is calcium. Or synaptic transmission. Of course, sodium and potassium are important because of what we know about changing membrane potentials, but the important signaling ion for release of neurotransmitter is calcium. We said acetylcholine is what? It is a type of neurotransmitter. Most widely used neurotransmitter, used in the brain, autonomic nervous system, peripheral nervous system, because it's at all neuromuscular junctions. And acetylcholine can have different effects in different parts of the body. So one neurotransmitter, right, might be excitatory in one part of the body and inhibitory on another part of your body. Now, how is it possible that one neurotransmitter can have different effects in different parts of the body? Same neurotransmitter, but different receptors. That's right. If the cell puts in different kinds of receptors, then that one neurotransmitter can have a different range of effects. And we're going to get started talking about some different kinds of receptors. There are nicotinic receptors, muscarinic receptors, and these are all going to be what we call cholinergic because they bind acetylcholine. And there's even some subtypes of nicotinic and muscarinic, which we probably won't get into. These can be excitatory or inhibitory. And let me just say that nicotinic type receptors are always excitatory, 100%. So a nicotinic acetylcholine ligand gated channel, since it's always excitatory, guess what kind of channel it is opening? Would you say sodium? Yeah, you would say sodium, right? Because that causes depolarization. Muscarinic channels can either open up sodium or potassium or chloride channels. It all depends on how it is put together inside the cell. Right, so put a big plus for nicotinic, plus/minus for muscarinic receptors. Now, what can you tell me about skeletal muscle? Is it voluntary or involuntary muscle? Voluntary muscle, that's right. When a nerve impulse reaches a skeletal muscle, can it ever make up its mind whether it wants to contract or not? Can it integrate information up? Say, I need a drink of that Coke, and I'm going to tell my muscles to grab that Coke bottle. What do? They always obey what I'm thinking. They can never make up their mind. They can never decide anything else. Those muscles will get excited and contract, and I can get this Coke bottle because it's under voluntary control. So if those muscles always are excited when a nerve impulse gets down there, what kind of channel do you think they have? They have nicotinic type channels, right? Because they can never say, no, thank you, I want to do something else, right? Skeletal muscles will just always obey your commands. And you know what? That's the only thing that you have voluntary control of in your whole body, and that is skeletal muscle. Everything else is controlled autonomically through these muscarinic channels. All right, so ligand-gated channel has both a neurotransmitter receptor site and an ion channel. They're coupled together. And that channel will open when the ligand binds the neurotransmitter. Here is a really good example of a nicotinic channel. This is a good exam figure. And I see a nice phospholipid bilayer right here. Ions can't move across the cell membrane, right, because they are hydrophilic. Only hydrophobic compounds can move all by themselves through the cell membrane. If it's an ion or a hydrophilic compound, it has to have a channel to go through it. And here is a nicotinic channel, and nicotinic sort of means acetylcholine, because only acetylcholine will bind to a nicotinic channel. And here are the receptor sites. There are two receptor sites on this protein, and this channel goes all the way across the membrane. Without acetylcholine binding to the binding sites, this channel is closed. When acetylcholine binds and it requires two on either side of this channel, then it opens up. So that seems kind of like a small perturbation, but think of your fingertip once again poking your neighbor poking you in the side, right? That's going to change conformation of this protein. It's going to open up, and the predominant effect is sodium rushing inside the cell because it's negative inside the cell. Some potassium is going to leak out, but by far more sodium enters. And when sodium enters, what happens to the cell here? It depolarizes. That's an excitatory event. That's why a nicotinic channel is always excitatory, because it's always going to allow sodium to enter the cell. And what does that produce, an EPSP or an IPSP? And EPST, which is excitatory, right? It's an excitatory signal. Yeah. Yep. One channel. One channel. There are two receptor sites on one channel. Yeah. So maybe I misspoke. Yeah, there are two receptor sites on one channel. And both receptor sites have to have acetylcholine bound to it before it opens up. All right. And don't forget, this acetylcholine came from the presynaptic cell when a action potential reached that axon terminus. So here is a really good example of a nicotinic channel always causing excitation because sodium enters the cell. Okay, let's see what we got right here. Ah, okay. G protein coupled channels. So there are channels, okay, that are associated with a G protein. And I'll tell you what a G protein is. A G protein is some proteins on the cell membrane that like to bind guanosine triphosphate, right? And so that's where the G comes from. Guanosine triphosphate is a lot like ATP. It's a high energy compound, right? So this does require a lot of energy to operate, but we find G protein coupled receptors and channels pretty much on every living system. So it's what we call highly conserved. This kind of communication between cells we find all over the place. And since all organisms have these things, that can be used as evidence for what? They can't prove, but there's evidence for evolution, right? And this kind of scheme works really, really well. And since it works so well, nothing else had to be invented by evolution because it works so well. So it might seem a little complicated, but our bodies love this thing, and not just our bodies, but bodies everywhere, okay? All right, so the neurotransmitter receptor is not part of the ion channel, as it is here, right? Here's the receptor, and here's the channel for a nicotinic channel. Okay, when the neurotransmitter binds to the receptor, it activates an ion channel at some other location via these G proteins. So let's look at an illustration of this thing. All right, you see a phospholipid bilayer. Nice, right? Nice phospholipid bilayer. And acetylcholine right here is hydrophilic, means it can't get across the cell. Right? So we want to look at a nice signal conduction scheme. How does this signal of acetylcholine get inside the cell if acetylcholine can't get in by itself? All right. Okay, so acetylcholine binds to a receptor, right? So here is the receptor. The receptor goes all the way across the membrane. Here's the extracellular side. Here's the intracellular side. And bound to the G protein is another protein that has three subunits. And this is what we call the G protein. If there's a G protein that binds to this receptor, we call it a G protein coupled receptor. G protein coupled receptor. Okay. And is this a voltage? Well, no, it's not even a channel, it's just a receptor. When a neurotransmitter binds, that releases these G proteins, and some of them dissociate, they unbind from each other, and they like to just travel around right on the surface of the membrane, and they can bump into other kinds of proteins that are in the cell membrane. Here is one. And I see that the beta and gamma subunit has bumped into this protein, and it just so happens that it's a channel. And I see that it is open. And so now potassium can actually leave the cell, and what does that produce? Does that produce depolarization? No, it produces hyperpolarization. What do we like to call hyperpolarization? That is an IPSP. This is a really good example of a muscarinic channel. It's a G protein coupled receptor. These G proteins then will activate a channel somewhere else on the cell membrane. And in this particular case, it's a potassium channel which is going to produce an IPSP. There are other cells might have a sodium channel here. When the G protein bumps into a sodium channel, that's going to produce an EPSP, right? So it all depends on what the nucleus decides to do, what kind of proteins to put inside the membrane, right? So that G protein opens some, right? If it's a potassium causing hyperpolarization. Or, for instance, if this potassium channel is open all the time, right, and potassium is leaving, which is going to hyperpolarize the membrane, if these G proteins close a potassium channel and prevent potassium from leaving, okay, and if we maintain this positive charge inside the cell and we accumulate positive charges inside the cell, what kind of event is that? If this potassium channel closes, right, then a positive charge will build up inside the cell because potassium can't leave. If we close a normally open potassium channel, that will cause depolarization as well. If we open up a potassium channel, that causes hyperpolarization. If we close one, that causes depolarization. It's just the flip side of the same coin. All right, so not only can there be different kinds of channels, but it depends if they're going from closed to open or open to closed. All right, then these things will dissociate from the channel and recombine with the alpha subunit and then recombine with the receptor, and this whole thing can happen over and over and over again. But it's going to require some GTP. So for this chapter, I think this is the level at which we want to understand a G protein coupled receptor. Okay. It works this channel is indirectly operated, okay, by this G protein coupled receptor. So not a really important concept in this chapter right now is that notice that acetylcholine never enters the cell. But it releases this beta and gamma subunit that act as a messenger, right, a signal to activate this channel right here. So we say that a G protein coupled receptor acts through a second messenger system. The first messenger is acetylcholine. The second messenger is this beta and gamma subunit, or you could even just say a G protein. So where do you always find a first messenger? Outside the cell. Where do you always find a second messenger? Inside the cell. Right, so people were confused with this for millions of years. How does a signal outside the cell cause physiology to change inside the cell? Through a second messenger system, and this is just one of the second messenger systems. Okay. All right. Well, in order for this synapse to work, once acetylcholine is released, we would like this synapse to be able to reset itself so that it can be stimulated once again, right? We just don't want this like a light switch to where if we turn the light switch on, we can never turn the lights off again. That would not be a very useful kind of switch, right? We'd like to be able to turn the lights off, and that means also we can turn the lights on at another time. So when acetylcholine is released from the presynaptic neuron, it can bind to this G protein. Here's a receptor that's coupled to a G protein. All right, so what kind of receptor is this? Is this going to be a nicotinic or muscarinic receptor? Okay, you might have to go back a couple slides. Once you study your slides, that will be obvious. It might not be obvious right now. But remember, nicotinic is a sodium channel that opens. This G protein is always going to be a muscarinic channel, right? G protein coupled receptors are always muscarinic, right? They both work with acetylcholine, all right? Well, we don't want this acetylcholine to exist in the synaptic cleft forever because then we won't be able to re-stimulate the cell. So there are enzymes that break acetylcholine down. And this is discovered in modern times, so it's called acetylcholinesterase. Acetylcholinesterase breaks the neurotransmitter down, and it breaks it down into choline and acetate. And you're familiar with acetate. How many carbons does acetate have? It has two, right? So here is acetate can be used in various other kinds of metabolic pathways that you're familiar with. And choline can be used as well, and acetate and choline can be taken back up by the presynaptic cell, put back together to make acetylcholine once again. But once acetylcholine is broken down into acetate and choline, it doesn't have the right shape to bind to the receptor, right? And so the synapse then is reset so that it can retransmit information. All right, so all neurotransmitters have different ways of being inactivated. Some have enzymes in the in the postsynaptic membrane. Other cells will take a neurotransmitter and actively pump it back into the presynaptic cell. We call that reuptake. And also astrocytes, remember astrocytes, they can take up neurotransmitter, which help inactivate its action within a synapse. The purpose of inactivation is there so that the postsynaptic cell doesn't always stay in an excited state. Okay? If it's always in an excited state, then it can't receive information from the presynaptic cell anymore because it's always excited. Information is only transmitted if the state of the postsynaptic cell can go from resting to excited or resting to inhibited. If it's always inhibited, then that neuron can't ever be used again. Okay? And that happens because there are nerve gases, nerve toxins that interact with these enzymes, right? And strychnine, for instance, and other kinds of nerve gases that we've heard on the news interact with these neurotransmitters and inactivating enzymes. Okay, just for fun, strychnine, important kind of poison in your body. It blocks the inactivation of a neurotransmitter in the spinal cord, and it blocks the action of an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So that somebody that's poisoned with strychnine, whenever they receive any kind of stimulus because the inhibitory neurotransmitter is released, their body just goes into a massive spasm because there's no inhibition anymore. And so if all their skeletal muscles are in contraction, guess what? Can't breathe. So it's a terrible kind of poison or nerve gas. Let's look at some other kinds of neurotransmitters. Acetylcholine in the peripheral nervous system, well, we kind of talked about that, right? Any neuron that releases acetylcholine is what we call a cholinergic neuron. We'll use that terminology. It uses acetylcholine. These large synapses between a somatic motor neuron and a skeletal muscle are huge. They're large, and they're cholinergic. All right, so as soon as acetylcholine is released from that motor neuron, that synapse is so huge and there are only nicotinic channels, and all those nicotinic channels produce EPSPs, and there's many, many, many of them because the neuromuscular junction is huge. That produces a huge graded potential, which always results in an action potential on a skeletal muscle cell. And that action potential, right, is what initiates muscle contraction. And the muscle cell is a little bit different from a neuron. Remember, in a neuron, dendrites and cell bodies only have ligand-gated channels, right? And you don't get to voltage-gated channels until you reach the axon hillock. But on a muscle cell, there are voltage-gated channels right within the synapse. So as soon as the synapse starts to depolarize, that will always cause, right, an action potential to be generated, and that EPSP is huge because it's a large synapse. We call that an end plate potential. End plate potentials always cause muscles to contract, unless they're poisoned somehow. Curare is a compound that blocks the action of acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction. That's a poison, right, so that poisons neuromuscular junctions, and curare is used for hunting in some parts of the world, right? Like Aboriginal peoples in South America knew where to get curare and coat their little tiny arrows with it, and they could take down really huge animals as a result of that, even with little tiny arrows, because they knew that was a poison for skeletal muscle. Monoamine neurotransmitters include serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. And so you know something about amino groups right now, and there are some amino acids that have amino groups on them. Serotonin is derived from tryptophan. We didn't have to learn much about amino acids, but tryptophan is an amino acid, and amino acids can be broken down into two groups. There are amino acids that your body can make, and there are amino acids that we no longer have the enzymes to make, so we have to have those amino acids in our diet. If there are amino acids that we need in our diet, we call those essential amino acids, and tryptophan is one of those essential amino acids. And Since tryptophan is necessary to make serotonin, serotonin can only be produced if you have the proper what? This is really strange the first time you think about it. Serotonin can only be produced in proper levels if your diet is proper, right? And so where can you get all of the essential amino acids? Easily. In meat products, right? You can get amino acids in the proper proportion if you're really careful on how you put a vegetarian diet together, but you have to be kind of careful with that. So your diet can influence neurotransmitters or synaptic transmission. Norepinephrine, serotonin are important neurotransmitters now known to be involved with mental illness, affective disorders, and schizophrenia. And so that's kind of interesting that a person's diet can influence things like clinical depression, right, or schizophrenia, because these amino acids are precursors to neurotransmitters. Norepinephrine and dopamine are derived from tyrosine. That's another essential amino acid. And where do you get essential amino acids from easily? From eating meat in particular. So these neurotransmitters, serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine are called catecholamines. All right, so here is another kind of synapse used in a monoamine pathway. We stop at 12:45, okay? And we're going to start talking about this next time. You can look it over. There are no enzymes that break norepinephrine down in the postsynaptic membrane. Reuptake is the way that this synapse is reset. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, like Tuesday. Please sign the sign-in sheet.